You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a UW-led effort to represent detained individuals and families in immigration court. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor Walker is urging the state Senate to get back together and vote on an incentive package aimed at keeping paper manufacturing jobs in the state. Meanwhile, Walker's former transportation secretary is criticizing the governor's statements on road funding, and a Marinette company is taking steps to clean up groundwater pollution caused by its chemicals. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks.
Let's start with the Kimberly-Clark incentives. Some new news out this week. Yesterday, I think it was. What's going on?
Right. So this started in January when Kimberly-Clark, which is this massive paper company that was founded in Wisconsin, is headquartered in Neenah, but employs about 3,000 people here and mostly in the Fox Valley, they announced that they were doing a big restructuring and closing 10 plants worldwide. And it later came out that they were planning to close two plants in Wisconsin and lay off a bunch of their workforce here. So this triggered a response by lawmakers. Calls for if we could do some sort of incentive package, maybe the company would stay or would not close these plants. And the assembly passed a substantial aid package back in February, and then nothing happened after that. It never got taken up by the Senate. And Kimberly-Clark, meanwhile, has moved forward with its restructuring plans. Now Governor Walker is calling on the state Senate to reconvene, to come in for a special session and pass the assembly bill to try to preserve this Kimberly-Clark plan.
And this one isn't breaking down on strictly partisan lines. Maybe there's some regional differences more than party differences. Here's a listen to Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson, a Democrat, talking about the incentives.
This should have been taken care of months ago. And I think somewhere along the line, you know, we kind of forgot what this is all about. And that is the fate and the fortune of potentially hundreds of workers right here in the Fox Valley.
And we see Governor Walker, a Republican, wants this to happen. The Republican-led assembly wants to pass this. But some Republicans in the state Senate are not on board, Rob.
Right. But what appears to be going on here, and I mean, it would seem the reason that it didn't reach the Senate floor in the first place is that Republicans do not seem to have the votes to pass this. There are members of the conservative wing who object to the package as a sort of a corporate welfare or that just the incentives themselves are too expensive or whatever. And on the other hand, I mean, you know, the Outagamie County executive notwithstanding, Democrats are not eager to support this bill either, because if it were to pass, for certain it would instantly become a campaign talking point for Governor Walker as he seeks reelection. In February, Assembly Democrats put forward their sort of their own package. Ultimately, only one Democrat in the Assembly voted for the bill that actually passed. So it would be it's a bit hard to see how Republicans get there. But perhaps Walker, if it's a strong priority for him, maybe he can twist some Republican arms on it.
We'll watch and see what happens. A deadline coming up at the end of the month on that. Elsewhere in Wisconsin politics, there is a governor's race happening. And this week, Governor Walker's former transportation secretary, Mark Gottlieb, renewed his criticism of Walker's approach to road funding. What is he saying?
Sure. Well, so Gottlieb, when he was Secretary of Transportation in the Walker administration, had put forward like some ambitious, expensive budgets for the state's roads, and had argued, you know, made the case for some highway expansion projects and just spending on roads. As we've probably talked about many times, for Governor Walker, the key position is to avoid raising gas taxes. That's been his most important priority. And so, in general, he has tended to not support some of the more expansive transportation plans. Most recently, he made this comment about maybe some of these roads don't need to be expanded that are slated to go from two lanes to four or whatever. And that seems to Gottlieb really did not like that, and came out with a lengthy statement and a long interview about what he views as inaccurate statements by the governor.
Now, Gottlieb is the third person who used to work in the Walker administration, now criticizing the governor. That includes ex-correction secretary Ed Wall, financial institution secretary Peter Bilston. Is this something that you think Democrats will try to capitalize on?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a new tension, and I mean, there is a difference here in that those first two that you mentioned, they have outright endorsed Tony Evers for governor and made ads for him. Gottlieb does not go that far. Although he declined to tell the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who he plans to vote for, so you can maybe read into that. But he's not making an endorsement. He's pushing back on factual claims. But he knows. The guy was a former assembly representative, a longtime Republican. He knows that there's an election campaign going on here, and I think he's probably aware of the political import of what he's saying.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories around Wisconsin this week. Rob, Tyco Fire Products in Marinette County is planning to take measures to prevent toxic chemicals at their testing facility from reaching the waters of Green Bay. Worries about the groundwater pollution from that site in particular. This is a little less of a high-profile story, except in that area, of course. Can you tell us what the problem is, Rob?
Right. Yeah, this is really interesting. So Tyco Fire Products makes fire suppression foam, which is an important tool, really a life-saving tool that firefighters use, but also something that involves toxic chemicals and things you don't want in the water, and they got into the water. So Lee Bergquist of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote about this. He wrote that that emails and other documents around the case have shown that there appear to have been multiple points in the year, over the years, in recent years, when chemicals have seeped into the groundwater, and the company now is working on addressing that. They're planning to install these new pollution control systems. They have already offered to pay for water treatment systems for property owners in the area whose wells are found to contain these related chemicals. But we don't, it's a thing where we don't exactly know the extent of this, and more testing is going to be needed, and the full cleanup process could be a while.
Yeah, do we have a sense of, I don't know about the science behind it exactly, a sense of the scale of the cleanup process and how long it could take?
Yeah, so this is, we should show some caution because this is sort of a, it's not like an oil spill. There are more questions here, right? So this specifically involves a type of chemical compound called perfluorinated chemicals, and this is more newer in the research on this is a little less established. Now, they appear to be associated with increased risk of asthma, liver damage, and some cancers. So it's not, there is an issue here, but at the same time, there aren't a lot of existing regulations. For instance, Wisconsin doesn't issue its own regulation on the levels for this particular type of chemical compound. So some of this is just a matter of mitigation and trying to head off any concerns before they would become a concern. In Green Bay water right now, there is nothing but trace amounts of this chemical. So it does not appear that it has gotten into the water in that population center to any extent, but we're looking at maybe 5 years for the process of the cleanup, and then certainly monitoring. And this is not they want to make sure that this doesn't get into water people are drinking.
Briefly, Rob, as we wrap up, a happier water story. I didn't know this happened. An annual contest for the state's best tasting drinking water took place this week in Madison. Who won?
The congratulations to your people, Rob, the good people of Madison who have the best tasting drinking water in Wisconsin. I love this idea because I have a pride about Wausau's delicious drinking water. I go to my parents' house in Illinois, and the water is terrible, which, sorry, Mom and Dad, but, I mean, you know it is true. So I didn't know this was even a thing, but apparently this is the 33rd year they've done this competition, and, Madison, the champion.
We'll leave it there, Rob. Thanks. I'll hoist a glass. I'll do the same.
That's right.
It's Rob Metzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us for our weekly look at the top news around the state. Law students from the UW recently traveled to Texas, but this is no ordinary field trip. These students, along with their professor, were there to represent detained migrants in immigration court, many of them seeking asylum in the United States. The South Texas Family Residential Facility in Dilley, Texas, is one of the largest immigration detention centers in the U.S. That's where our next guest went to take part in this work. They join us now to share more about their experiences there. Aaron Barbado is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and Daniela Juarez is a third-year law student at UW-Madison who made the trip. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Daniela, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Aaron, let's start with you. Why did you want to make this trip with your law students?
Well, I actually wasn't the person who planned it from the beginning. Law students have been going down to this facility since 2014. And so the people that have really planned this this trip was LASA. And Daniela is the president of LASA, and she can tell you a little bit about that. But at this point, it's just a really wonderful learning opportunity for law students to learn how to represent people in detention.
And Daniela, let's bring you in. Why did you and the group want to do this?
Well, I have personal ties. So I came to the U.S. when I was 5 years old. I was born in Mexico. So this is just something that hits really close to home, really close to my family. And it's something that affects our community. You know, I'm originally from California, but even in Wisconsin, it's something that we see. And it was something that I felt the rest of the law students really wanted to get involved in. And why not?
And Aaron, you were in Dilley, Texas, home of one of the biggest immigration detention centers in the United States. Can you kind of set the scene for us, describe it for us?
Sure. So in 2014, our government built this detention facility, or it's a family considered a family residential facility that can house up to 2,400 mothers and children. And so we weren't privy to see most of the facility. We saw the area where the attorneys met with clients, and then I saw the immigration court that was there, as well as a building where the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services held interviews. So we didn't see the living quarters or where people eat or anything like that.
And Daniela, can you talk about some of the people and families that you met and worked with while you were there?
A lot of single mothers, a lot of young mothers, a lot of children, mostly from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. All of them had a very powerful and very gruesome story to tell. And something that we saw across the board was how much these women were just fighting for their children. I'll sum it up for you in a quote from a mom that I was sitting with. And let me preface this by saying, like, we as volunteers had to be really strong when we were talking to them, but I completely lost it in this interview. And the mom was telling me, she's like, she was confused by the law and what asylum was. And if I have to go back, it's fine. I'll die. But just keep my children. Just make sure they are okay. That's what we saw.
Can you talk about some of the stories from these moms, I guess, in particular, of what they were leaving? What was so bad at home that made them take this dangerous journey with an uncertain outcome?
Yeah. Generally, we saw domestic violence fueled by gang violence, fueled by poverty, by lack of resources. So we had women who were very young, who did not have access to education, who did not have access to a job, and they were supporting children, and then you have either a terrible life at home where husband is mistreating them, or you have gang violence where, like, they're making some money and someone from a gang is taking it away or hurting them. We had stories where bodies would end up in front of their homes as threats, or family members were killed because they weren't paying their quote-unquote rent to continue to work or live. And so these are things that I think as Americans here, we can't really imagine or quite understand. But it was very normal to them. And that sounds really weird. But when they were telling me their story, I had to really pull that information because they didn't understand that what they were living through was not normal. And that life is not something that you should be living.
And Aaron, let's talk about legal representation a little bit. People might think of a criminal case involving an American citizen and that citizen having the right to an attorney if they can't afford one. One is provided for them. That right is not guaranteed, as I understand it, in these immigration cases. Do I have that right?
You do. That's correct. So in removal defense in immigration court, when someone is facing deportation, they aren't afforded a government attorney. You can have an attorney if you can afford an attorney, but most attorneys, private bar attorneys, you know, it's very expensive, especially for someone fleeing from another country for violence. So, and especially for someone who is in Dilley, Texas, which is very far from, an hour from San Antonio, and there just are 2,400 people that need representation. So there's a lack of access to justice there and a lack of legal representation. So that's why these volunteer attorneys are incredibly important to ensure that these women have some sort of access to justice.
On a practical level, what are volunteer attorneys doing with their clients?
You know, there's not even that much we can do because of the volume of women that are down there. We had about 22 volunteers the week we were there, and we would see up to 90, 100 women as a group every day. And so that doesn't give us a lot of time to meet with the women, especially to describe what the process is and to tell them what type of questions they may be asked so that they're prepared and knowledgeable to tell their story in a credible and truthful manner. And so I often felt like we just didn't have enough time to give full representation, which was really hard as someone who believes in that people in removal defense need representation in order to have due process of the law.
Daniela, as a law student here, what was the experience like? What does it make you think about your own maybe future career as an attorney?
Well, I came into law school knowing I wanted to be an immigration attorney. And so I think it has been quite a roller coaster because I don't think I understood what that meant coming in. Being there as a law student was really hard for a couple of reasons. One, we know enough about the law to know right from wrong. We know certain things, but we don't know enough to actually do much yet. We can't practice. We can't, you know. So being there with that knowledge was very heartbreaking. And we did the best we could. I speak Spanish, and so I was able to do the work without a translator, and usually I had someone else with me. And we got through about 8 women on day one, and then after that we had to bring it down because it was so much. But I think everybody was feeling a little broken because we don't really understand the system.
Now, that's down in Texas. There are immigration cases that go on here in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, often at Chicago courts, I believe. Do you and your organization work on those cases as well?
I did when I was part of IJC, the Immigrant Justice Clinic. And so I did an asylum case in Chicago, and it was amazing, and we got to see it through. And I think that was the highlight of last year because I got to meet him and hear his whole story, and it took months, but we got to present his case. Me and my partner represented him, and he was released that day, and we took him out to lunch, and it was a really amazing day.
And Aaron, that highlights a big difference. Daniela was talking about being with that client kind of through the whole run of their court, their case, which can go on, I imagine, months, maybe years, I don't know, versus volunteering and being able to drop in just briefly with these clients. Is there any kind of access or attempt to give access to longer-term representation at a place like this facility in Texas?
You know, the organization that runs the volunteer opportunity in Texas, you know, they're really focused on this credible fear interview part of the this process so that these women can be released from detention. And then once they're released, they can find legal representation where they relocate in the United States. So in some cases, we will be able to represent the women if they're relocated to Wisconsin, and we would like to continue the representation. But there's just too many, and we can't help everybody. There's just not enough resources for that. So ideally, every woman who was released would find legal representation where they go. But the truth is, there's just not enough nonprofit immigration services in the United States to serve everyone.
Daniela, are you hoping to organize another trip down to Texas?
Yeah, we are. And so our LASA, Latinx Law Student Association, is thinking of doing another one in the spring. And so that's what we plan to do moving forward, to do one in the fall and one in the spring. This time it landed in the summer just because of scheduling. And we are starting to fundraise for it already. I'm hoping, I think it's an amazing experience for law students to see it firsthand. And it's also, as Aaron said, it's such much, like much needed help.
It's a good place to leave it. Daniela, thanks a lot for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and Daniela Juarez is a third-year law student at UW-Madison. They recently traveled to Texas to represent detained people and families in immigration court. Now, swamps don't always have the best reputation. They're seen as dark, murky, and stagnant. Maybe that's why the phrase "drain the swamp" has taken off in Washington, D.C. But our next guest says that real-life swamps should be preserved, not drained, and that swamps and wetlands play a very important role in our environment and in the fight against climate change. Additionally, with increasing heavy rain events and storms, including the massive hurricane currently impacting the East Coast, wetlands may become more important than ever. Jillian Davies joins us now. She's a senior ecological scientist at the Massachusetts-based BSC Group and a visiting scholar at the Global Development Environment Institute at Tufts University. She recently co-wrote a piece for The Conversation titled "What the World Needs Now to Fight Climate Change, More Swamps." Jillian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, Jillian, swamps, historically, maybe even up to the present day, people seem to think of them as literally wastelands and things that, you know, to make use of it, you have to drain it, dam it, dike it to make it useful for agriculture, for people to live on. Can you talk a little bit about our negative attitude toward wetlands over human history?
Yes, it certainly goes way back, probably thousands of years, because swampland is generally not good for agricultural purposes and definitely not good for building a house on, for instance. However, that reflects a lack of understanding of what wetlands and swamps do for us. They store water during flooding, and there are now some recent studies that show that have been looking at how much wetlands prevent flood damage from the kind of hurricane that's hitting North Carolina right now, this Hurricane Florence. And they studied the effects of wetlands in reducing flood damage during Hurricane Sandy that hit the Northeast a number of years ago, and found that it saved wetlands, communities with wetlands had saved $625 million worth of prevented flood damage during that time. And they also have reduced the impacts of coastal storms on coasts. And we also are seeing with climate change, we're seeing more drought, and wetlands store water on the landscape and then become a source of water when we need water supply. So people now think of them more as a sponge that absorbs excess water when we have too much, but then is a source of releasing water when we have too little. So those are just some of the things. And then the other thing that I think people didn't understand long ago is that although wetlands only occupy between 5 and 8% of the land surface on the Earth, depending on which study you look at, they actually store 30% of the world's soil carbon. And that is really important because when carbon's in the soil, it's not in the atmosphere. The plant in a wetland will pull, as all plants do, all plants pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and then when they die, microbes decompose it into soil. And because wetlands are flooded with water, that water prevents the organic material from basically decomposing back into the atmosphere and releasing its carbon to the atmosphere. And that's why in wetlands you have the dark black mud that is really deep and soft. That's decomposed organic matter, and it's carbon-based. And it's so wetlands, basically, they are like forests. They act as lungs for the planet. And so they're part of the carbon solution.
How much wetlands have we lost globally in the history of human development? Do we have a ballpark figure?
Sure. Ballpark figure for areas where this wetland loss has been measured, and in some parts of the world it has not yet been measured, is over 50%, a little bit over 50%, which is huge because we've lost all of those ecosystem services in those areas that when we lose the wetlands that I just talked about.
Talking to Jillian Davies, senior ecological scientist at the Massachusetts-based BSC Group, about the value of wetlands and why she says we shouldn't be draining swamps. We should be preserving them and restoring them. And you write in that piece we're talking about, Jillian, that even in the climate change community, people very worried about climate change, we may be overlooking the value of wetlands. Why is that?
That's an interesting story, too. One of our co-authors, Dr. Bill Mumma, has been very active in the global climate change policy discussion for decades. And he says that that community of scientists, most of them are physical scientists. And he himself started out as an atmospheric chemist, for instance, who moved into the policy realm. And so they haven't thought as much about the natural ecosystems as they've thought about the human-caused emissions part. And the human-caused emissions part is the origin of the problem. So it's really important what they're doing. It's just, and then recently they have incorporated forests to some extent, and they're beginning to incorporate wetlands, but there just hasn't been a full appreciation by climate scientists of the significance of the role of wetlands. Like I said, they occupy a really small percent of the land surface, but have a disproportionate role in pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it and keeping it locked up. And some of the biggest areas of this sort of soil carbon are in the northern latitudes where we have basically frozen wetland soil that's called permafrost. And that carbon has been locked up for thousands of years. It's accumulated ever since the last ice age, basically. And as temperatures warm, that permafrost is thawing. And as it thaws, it's releasing large quantities of carbon, which then create more warming because it's adding carbon to the atmosphere from the thawing organic soils. And then that more warming accelerates the thawing of the permafrost, so it gets into this feedback loop that it creates more global warming, which creates more thawing. And it could get to the point where that thawing is releasing as much carbon every year as the U.S. currently releases due to human emissions annually, which is a vast amount. That just gives you some sense of how much carbon is locked up in those soils and how much could be released. So we really need to keep the global temperature from going much higher, so that that kind of positive, positive meaning it's all going in the same direction, not that it's a good thing, feedback loop doesn't get going to a point where we can't stop it.
Talking about the value of wetlands, Jillian Davis is with us, ecological scientist, co-author of a piece in The Conversation called What the World Needs Now to Fight Climate Change, More Swamps. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the value, the role that wetlands play? Do you think they're in need of more protection around the world, in the U.S., here in Wisconsin? Is this an issue in your community, wetlands being filled, replaced? Many of us, including the city of Madison, are built on what used to be wetlands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about wetlands with Jillian Davies, senior ecological scientist at the Massachusetts-based BSC Group and visiting scholar at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University. Join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Has your community experienced a conflict between the need for new development and the need for preserving wetlands? What ended up happening? Do you think enough is being done to preserve these areas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Cindy is on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, you had made a comment about how we don't understand our wetlands or preserve our wetlands. Like, you know, we've learned our lesson over the years. Well, actually, I don't think we have. We're not preserving our wetlands, and here in Wisconsin just a couple of years ago, they passed a bill which basically gives people free rein to destroy wetlands without even getting a permit. So we still don't understand the value of wetlands, and I don't know if we ever will before it's too late.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Jillian, is that the case around the country, that you think at the government level wetlands aren't appreciated enough?
Thank you for that call, and you're absolutely right that not everybody understands this. I guess I was speaking more scientifically and in some communities more than others, and you're absolutely right about what's happened in Wisconsin. Wisconsin had a very strong wetlands protection law that, the Republican side of the aisle really took that apart, and fortunately you have a wonderful state wetlands association, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, that built a strong coalition to at least protect some of your protective legislation, so that effort by the Republican legislators was not as successful as they had initially intended. But I'm hopeful that your state will build consensus to bring back the good protections that you used to have. And then it just as troubling is what's going on at the federal level right now with this current administration's efforts to really dismantle the 2015 Clean Water Rule and they would like to redefine the waters of the United States based on Judge Scalia's definition, and apparently Judge Scalia went to a dictionary for his definition, and he did not turn to science. His approach did not incorporate the scientific understanding that we do have, whereas the 2015 Clean Water Rule was based on a report called the Connectivity Report that looked at how wetlands and waters from headwaters down to the ocean are connected and are the different components that are needed to provide all of us with clean drinking water and protect our water supply. And that report, based on 1,200 or more peer-reviewed articles, provided the scientific basis for the 2015 Clean Water Rule. And there was a lengthy public comment period, and this effort to repeal and replace the 2015 Clean Water Rule has had a much more limited comment period, so they don't want input from citizens. They're doing their best to limit it unnecessarily. And it's, you know, I think it's driven by special interests who have made campaign donations. That's, you know, so this is what we're seeing. It's a dismantling of protections we already have and a turning away from using scientific research to inform our decisions on how to protect our public interests and our common wealth, where water and air are, you know, our common wealth.
I want to bring on another caller. Terry is with us in Hales Corners. Terry, hi.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you for this incredibly informative discussion. My main concern is that climate change is leading to heavier precipitation events in Wisconsin and in the Midwest. And my understanding of the state law is that if you eliminate a wetland, you need to create 1.5 times as many, but it doesn't have to be in the same watershed. So that combination of things, you know, greatly concerns me. And again, thank you for this very insightful discussion.
Terry, thanks for that call. And Jillian, I want to get into that replacement wetland issue. In many cases, you can fill in a wetland if you create new ones elsewhere. Are new wetlands, person-made wetlands, as good as ones that have been there longer?
They are not as good, generally speaking. Ecosystems are very complex, and they take you know, hundreds or thousands of years to evolve to a point that you find them in at any given moment. And what people are finding when we construct mitigation wetlands is that you can replace some of the functionality. So it's certainly a good thing to be doing, because where development is unavoidable, for instance, creating a wetland definitely helps to replace some of the functions, but we find that time is an important component to ecological function, and time cannot be replaced quickly. For instance, the soils in a wetland, they're invisible, and so they're very hard to understand, but there's a lot of structure and chemistry going on. There's a lot of microbial life going on, and that all evolves over time. So the microbes and the soil structure in a brand new wetland is not the same as one that has been in place for hundreds or thousands of years. And so the carbon function in particular in a new freshwater wetland can take decades to hundreds to thousands of years to come back to the same kind of capacity to sequester or store carbon in the wetland. Interestingly, saltwater wetlands like a salt marsh or a mangrove, they have a different microbial community and a different soil chemistry, so they actually can start storing and sequestering carbon fairly rapidly after a new one has been created or built. And so it depends on which function you're looking at. If you want to create some flood storage, you can, you know, do that a little more easily than you can, for instance, replace that carbon storage function.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Jillian Davies, senior ecological scientist at the Massachusetts-based BSC Group, visiting scholar at Tufts University. She recently co-wrote a piece for The Conversation titled "What the World Needs Now to Fight Climate Change: More Swamps." A new business hub in Milwaukee called the Sherman Phoenix is nearing completion, and supporters hope the development will drive investment to that part of the city. But as Jimena Conde reports, the project is also offering more than 20 small business owners a support system often unavailable to Milwaukee entrepreneurs.
So that's where Embody Yoga will be. And this area will be our vegan restaurant and our Buffalo Boss.
Joanne Sabir, developer and future Sherman Phoenix tenant, maps out where businesses will move into come November. The former BMO Harris Bank is not quite ready. Construction equipment stands next to the main entrance. And while the back end has new plate glass windows, the windows at the front of the building are still boarded up. The bank and several other nearby buildings were destroyed by fire during two nights of unrest in Sherman Park a little more than 2 years ago. Protesters set the businesses alight after police fatally shot 23-year-old Sylval Smith.
We really look at this as a place where you can live. You'll be able to get acupuncture, yoga, eat some fried chicken. It's organic. And some vegan food. There'll be a spectrum of goodness.
Sabir's helped lead the $4 million fundraising efforts to convert the building into a commercial center. The project is also providing a comprehensive support system for its tenants, most of whom are people of color. They'll be able to master technical skills required to run their growing businesses through workshops, a diverse pool of mentors, and coaching sessions. They'll also have access to wellness services like acupuncture. Sabir says entrepreneurs of color don't often get the support they need to grow.
There is access to capital that a lot of black-owned businesses are not aware of. There are angel investors that black-owned businesses have not been tapped into. So it's really opening the sphere of opportunity.
Beth Haskovic is with the Local Initiative Support Corporation, a Milwaukee nonprofit. She says there are dozens of organizations that help entrepreneurs with accessing capital, marketing, and bookkeeping, but there are gaps in support. And information about resources may not reach business owners of color.
The segregation in Milwaukee impacts people of color differently than their white counterparts in this city. And so I think just the way that people build relationships, the networks that they have, limits people's ability to connect to resources that might be available to them.
Haskovic says entrepreneurs may also find themselves working with multiple agencies.
You know, they could go one place to get a loan. They could go another place to get access to business coaching. They could go to a third place to get mentorship. That's a lot of work for somebody who's trying to run a business.
In the weeks after the Sherman Park unrest, Governor Scott Walker announced a $4.5 million plan to rebuild economically disadvantaged Milwaukee neighborhoods through housing and job training. The Sherman Phoenix was developed after those funds were distributed, but is in the same mold. The development is supposed to symbolize a rise from the ashes and a rebirth. It has gotten $250,000 in other state grants and $215,000 in city funding. Joanna Brooks is one of the Sherman Phoenix's future tenants and heads the entrepreneurship support program. She says most of the Phoenix's tenants already had thriving businesses.
We were here. We were doing this work. We were deeply rooted in our communities doing this work. We just didn't have, again, the access and the attention and some of the resources, and now that's happening through the Sherman Phoenix.
Planners are hoping the project will attract new customers as a destination like the Third Ward's public market. At a neighborhood festival, resident Rhonda Hill says she's skeptical about whether the Sherman Phoenix will gain popularity outside the community. But she says she's still excited.
The Sherman Phoenix being there and having a lot of black businessmen and women there that other people from the neighborhood can see, that inspires, I think, hope and gives the rest of the residents an idea of, okay, what can I think of? What can I dream of? What can I do?
Current tenant Joanna Brooks says that's the sort of thinking the project hopes to inspire. For Brooks, reaching the milestone of having a brick and mortar is also pushing her to think about what's next for her business. Jimena Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll find out why a U.S. foreign investment program that was almost eliminated last year is getting bipartisan support for increased funding now. Spoiler alert, it's because of China. Some American cities are booming in the long recovery from the Great Recession, but our guest takes us on a tour of the cities that have been left behind. Plus, a look at some of the best live albums of all time. You could share your favorites. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.